So I want to bring on Dr. Michael Greger, the author of How Not to Die, Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reverse Disease. It's just out today. Dr. Greger, of course, is a physician, author, and internationally recognized speaker on nutrition, food safety, and public health issues, a founding member and fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Dr. Greger is licensed as a general practitioner specializing in clinical nutrition. Currently, he proudly serves as the public health director at the Humane Society of the United States, and Dr. Greger is a graduate of the Cornell University School of Agriculture and the Tufts University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Greger. How are you?
So excited to be here, particularly on Big Lunch Day. I can't think of anyone I'd rather share it with.
Oh, big hug, Michael! Hug! Happy launch day!
Thank you so much!
Okay, so I got a question for you. I know you've got a very packed afternoon and probably the rest of the week and month is filled with interviews and all kinds of promotional things for your book called How Not to Die. My question is, how are you going to live through this?
Oh my God, I've got 60 cities, 6 countries in the next few months. It's gonna be tough, but you know what the secret is?
No.
Healthy diet. You should check it out.
No.
Real Meals. It's amazing.
Healthy diet. I can't believe it. I never heard of such a thing.
I know. You gotta check it out.
Okay, now, I'm very proud of you and I'm so excited you put this book out and I wish you all the best and I congratulate you. But I also want to congratulate myself because I read it. This book is over 500 pages, over 400 pages really of material, and then over 100 pages of notes.
Yeah, references. Yeah, scientific citations. Yes.
There's a lot of stuff in this book.
Yes.
I thought we might touch on a few. I dog-eared a lot of pages and of things that I was kind of curious about, but everything in this book is important. From people who think they know everything about food and for people that know very little, everybody should read it, period.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That is kind of you to say. No, absolutely. I learned stuff. I thought it was just going to be, you know, kind of a repackaging of all the science I'd put together for nutritionfacts.org over the years. But, you know, there was, you know, gaps I needed to fill, and so I learned all sorts of good stuff. I'm eating differently now than I was before I started the book, and so I'm so excited to share, particularly all the kind of practical stuff, the second half of the book, where, you know, I go kind of beyond just the kind of peer-reviewed scientific literature, talk about, you know, just how to make, translate the mountain of evidence into kind of day-to-day healthy living.
Well, I think we've come a long way from, 30 years ago when we thought whole wheat and wheat germ was all we needed to stay healthy.
Right, wheat germ. Wow. Yes. Now, the germ of the wheat is good, but it should be part of the whole thing. That's the problem. Yes.
Right. But, I mean, do you even remember back then? You were probably just a baby. But that was what everybody thought was healthy.
I remember when the soy milk was brown and chunky.
Yeah, okay. Well, the first thing I wanted to mention, I've highlighted a few things. So this one I loved. For all of those people that were vegetarian and then decided that they craved meat too much and started eating meat again, according to your introduction, people who once ate vegetarian diets but then started to eat meat at least once a week experience a 146% increase in odds of heart disease, 152% increase in stroke, 166% increase in diabetes, and a 231% increase in odds for weight gain. Whoa.
Yeah, no, that's really, yeah, no, so that's new. That's extraordinary new research. In fact, that's some of the new research I added from, I mean, that's not up on the website. Of course, I'll eventually make a video about it. But, you know, that's a really kind of a critical piece of information, and it's something that's never been looked at. I mean, they've studied vegetarians before, they've studied meat eaters, and so what they've done is, you know, they study meat eaters who have turned into vegetarians, right, who stop eating meat, and what happens, all the beneficial things to your health. But for the first time, they're like, wait a second, what about people who have been eating vegetarian, like feeling so healthy, doing so great, they're like, I could just, you know, what's a little, you know. And then followed them out, and what happened? And they had, you know, this extraordinary increase in risk very rapidly. In fact, it really mirrors what happens when people start eating healthy. You know, I'm constantly amazed by these studies showing all these, you know, beneficial effects of, you know, vegetarian diets. When you look at the average duration of vegetarian diets, typically in these studies about 4.5 years or so. So, and we're looking at middle-aged populations, and vegetarians doing so much better than those who eat meat in terms of chronic disease like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, things like that. But wait a second. You're not comparing vegetarians to omnivores. You're comparing omnivores to omnivores that just stopped being omnivores a little while ago. Right? I mean, you know, they just recently, you know, it's like if you compared smokers to a non-smoker who quit yesterday, they're technically a non-smoker, but if you didn't find different lung cancer rates, you wouldn't be surprised. You just stopped smoking the other day, right? But the remarkable thing about diet is that very rapidly risk drops, which is such a great optimistic message for them. I mean, you could have been eating crappy your whole life and you can dramatically drop your risk. But the flip side of that, what that study showed, is that your risk can jump right back up, shoot right back up very rapidly when one goes back to eating the unhealthy standard American diet.
Well, I love that, and I didn't know that. So I was that was like the first thing I read, and I was like, whoa, yeah, this is going to be a good read. And I'm going to use that a lot. Okay, so the next thing I wanted to talk about is our teeth. And you wrote, if you looked at the teeth of people who lived more than 10,000 years ago before the invention of the toothbrush, you'd notice that they had almost no cavities. They never flossed a day in their lives, yet no cavities. Does that mean I don't have to floss my teeth?
Ha! That means...
I hate flossing.
You're not a big flossing fan?
No.
Well, I mean, the point I was trying to make is that cavities, dental cavities, are a preventable disease. Right? I mean, it was 10,000 years before the invention of the toothbrush, but also 10,000 years before the invention of the candy bar. I mean, so now, I mean, if you're eating your refined foods, you're eating processed foods, well, then you're creating this, you know, cavity-forming environment in your mouth, and you better do something to mediate that risk, which is typically, you know, brushing and flossing and regularly seeing a dentist. But, you know, and so you say, well, wait a second. Well, if it's preventable, why do people still get cavities? Well, they get cavities because the benefits outweigh, you know, like dessert outweighs the risk of the dentist chair. Like, all right, fine, I'll go get a cavity filled every once in a while. You know, I'd still want to eat one. And look, that's fine. As long as people understand the predictable consequences of their actions, you know, what more can I do as a physician, right? I mean, if you think the risk, you know, outweighs the benefit, if you think the benefits outweigh the risk for you and your family, then go for it. I mean, I certainly enjoy the occasional indulgence. I've got a good dental plan, right? But
exactly.
What if instead of talking about the plaque on our teeth, we're talking about the plaque building up inside of our arteries, another disease that can be prevented through dietary change by eating a plant-based diet, right? Now we're not talking about scraping tartar anymore. Now we're talking life or death. And so in that scenario, then one really has to weigh heavily whether one wants to continue down the path and suffer the consequences of eating the miserable diet that the society has foisted on people.
You know, you were just saying that you're doing the most that you can do as a physician, but what you're doing is you're giving everyone all the facts and respecting them enough so that they can make choices. And most physicians do not do that. In fact, you talk about it in the book where decisions were made, policies were made because they were patronizing us and believed that we couldn't make our own choices. They just assumed we didn't want to eat all vegetables, that we would always want to eat meat, things like that.
Isn't that outrageous? I mean, right. When you hear about, you know, dietary recommendations, when the, you know, American Heart Association comes out and says something, or, you know, the dietary guidelines, or they're making decisions, and consciously, if you actually, you know, read the literature when they talk about how they come up with these recommendations, I mean, they're like, yeah, okay, the science says this, but that's not doable, right? No one's going to do that. So, okay, so we'll just kind of water it down and tell people to do that, right? I mean, it's like telling people to get, 22 minutes of exercise a day. That's the current recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
22 minutes of moderate physical activity. Okay, now, does the science show that that's the optimum amount? Like, we shouldn't get 25 because, you know... No, they think, okay, I mean, so I talk about the exercise literature, how, exercising half an hour a day is better than 20, and 45 is better than half an hour, then an hour a day is better, 90 minutes a day is even better than an hour a day, and then the literature stops because nobody exercises more than that every day. I mean, they just don't have big enough studies of people who actually exercise more than 90 minutes a day, 7 days a week. And so it just kind of maxes out. Okay, so they take that data, you know, and so at every step, you can get decreased risk of dying prematurely. And so they look at that data and say, oh, let's tell everybody 22, right? Saying, well, if we tell them too much, it'll just kind of scare them away. They won't do anything, right? So you kind of look, you can kind of see into their psychology. So same thing with diet. So if they told people, eat a plant-based diet, don't eat meat, whether or not the literature says that doesn't matter because they figure, look, no one's going to eat this way. And so we'll actually save more lives if we just tell them to cut down, to moderate their intake, right? For an individual, that's not good advice, but on a population scale, maybe we'll actually save more lives in the end if we don't tell, if we hide the truth from the public. And these are, I talk about, I have videos, showing, well, these are the papers where they came up with these recommendations, and they're very open about it. They're like, yes, the science says this, but we want to make it practical. Well, I mean, that's just, it seems so patronizing. It's like, look, just tell me the truth. Look, I may choose not to do it, but that's my decision, not yours.
Well, you know what's wrong with it? I mean, there's a lot wrong with it, but one of the things that I find that's wrong is because doctors are dumbing us down and assuming we don't want to go all the way, and maybe some people won't want to, but if we were getting the truth, more people would believe it and act on it. I know in my own work, I had advanced ovarian cancer in 2006. I should be dead. And I decided I didn't want to die. And so a lot of the information in your book isn't new to me because I dug at that time to find out everything that I needed to do. And I mean everything that I needed to do because I didn't want to leave anything to chance. And so now I talk to people who are going through some health crises and I tell them, here's what you need to do. And some of these people, they just don't believe it or they think it's too difficult. But I think if more doctors were saying, this is the best that you can do for the best results, more people would believe it and more people would do it.
Sure. No, it would just be part of the mainstream. Absolutely. And I mean, eventually that'll happen just because of the democratization of information. I mean, you just can't hide the truth anymore because before, doctors kind of had a monopoly on health information, right? So if a drug company wanted to manipulate, the practice of medicine, they just have to go to the doctors and be like, okay, we get the doctors to prescribe this drug, everybody will take this drug, and that's just how it'll be. But all of a sudden now, with the internet, people can find out, wait a second, what really are the side effects? They're like, what's the risks and benefits of taking this drug, and what are other options that maybe the doctor didn't tell me? And then they go to the doctor and say, well, wait a second. You want me to go on these multiple blood pressure pills, but what about this study that I saw on nutritionfacts.org, of course, that said that, people that eat this way, can have their doctor wean themselves off of high blood pressure medications. They don't have it. There's whole populations that don't get high blood pressure as they age because they're eating a certain way. I mean, so, what about that? And the doctor will probably be like, I've never heard of any of that. And if they're a good doctor, they'll be like, well, I'll look into it because they want to help people. They want to have the tools to benefit folks. If doctors just wanted to make money, they would have, went to Wall Street or something. I mean, at least the initial spark for people going to medicine is they want to help people. And this gives them an opportunity, a tool that they were not – get put in their toolbox in medical training, an extraordinarily powerful tool to deal with the vast majority of what most primary care docs see today, which is chronic disease. It's about 80%. And so, look, there's still acute conditions where medicine is great at curing infections, broken bones. But when it comes to chronic diseases, which lays to waste most of Americans, the heart disease and diabetes and obesity and hypertension, and these are diseases of lifestyle. And so, you know, you have to treat the cause. If you don't treat the cause, then you just, you know, kind of covering up the symptoms or trying to mediate the consequences.
I don't want to knock doctors because you can't live with them, can't live without them kind of thing. And I'm very grateful for many of the doctors that helped me. But you said most doctors go into medicine because they want to help people. And I'm sure that's true. But I also think a lot of them want to play God.
That's a good question. I haven't seen survey data they just don't ask that question. So, God, no God, A or B, none of the above. There definitely can be kind of in training, if you don't already have it already, they do instill this kind of, you know, arrogant self-confidence that, you know, may be useful in a clinical encounter in terms of the placebo effect. You know, if you go in telling somebody that a sugar pill is going to do something for them, and if you say that powerful enough with enough kind of gravitas, and really then the placebo actually does something for them. I mean, absolutely remarkable physiological effects of placebos, particularly when backed up by a doctor saying, this will help you or this will do, you know, whatever. And so imagine that exact same confidence associated with something that actually has some benefit, actually has some pharmacological properties, actually may actually help the person. So that kind of arrogance may benefit, but it's fundamentally dishonest. I'd like to see medicine get to more of a, you know, kind of cooperative approach with the patient, and ensure every patient has fully informed consent and knows what they're getting into. It's their body. They should be able to do whatever they want with it.
Let's clone a bunch of Michael Gregors, huh?
Ha!
That'd be funny. Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about placebos because you just reminded me of something I read in this great book, How Not to Die, that I was reading recently about depression and drugs that are used to treat depression are no better in their effectiveness than a placebo.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Oh, God, my jaw was so dropped for so long.
No, this pissed me off. I mean, when I looked at this body of literature, so there are thousands of studies, literally thousands of published studies, showing that antidepressants work. Until someone came along and said, well, this is a little suspicious. This is a little fishy. I mean, nothing always works. I don't know. They said, I wonder if there's some proportion of studies that come out that show that they didn't work, but then they were just kind of quietly shelved and so never published. Yeah, because the drug companies are pay for the studies to evaluate their own drugs. That's the system. So it's a very fox guarding hen house kind of thing. So you want to put out a new drug. The FDA says, okay, you test your own drug and see if it works and see if it's safe. That's the system we have. Okay. And so the drug company makes this trial, and if it works, they publish it. What if it doesn't work? Well, that's what the question was. Thankfully, when drug companies do this, they actually have to register their trials with the government. So even though the government's not paying for it, they say, okay, we're going to test this drug, we'll see if it works. This is, you know, and so... So what these researchers did was just go back to the FDA and looked at all the data. So demanded to go back and get all that trial data, all the unpublished trials, and it turns out that they just didn't publish any of the ones that were negative, and that is actually a wash when you put all the data together, both unpublished and published, such that for the vast majority of people, There's no, you know, kind of clinically discernible benefit of antidepressant drugs compared to utter sugar pills. And even worse than that, of course, is that sugar pills, if that's true, then sugar pills beat out drugs. Why? Because drugs cause side effects, significant side effects, sexual dysfunction, we talk about the SSRIs, all sorts of things.
They can make you depressed.
That's the insult to injury. That just absolutely killed me. So it turns out that if you give that taking antidepressants actually increases the duration of depression, kind of turns it from more kind of an episodic disease into a more kind of constant disease that you don't get when you treat depression with placebo, with sugar pills. People get depressed, they get better. And so that's why, because it's, it starts out as an episodic disease, a certain percentage of people are just going to get better within a few months period, even if you do nothing, which is what a placebo is, you're doing nothing. And so, and the same percentage of people get better whether they're taking, antidepressants or whether they're taking placebo. But the problem is, in the placebo, they get better, they go on, live their lives. But those that took the antidepressants to muck with their brain chemistry got better at the same rate as the placebos, but had a greater likelihood in the future than those taking the placebo of becoming depressed again and for longer periods. And so it's actually making the problem worse and thereby kind of increasing dependency on those drugs, which is great for the drug companies, but terrible in terms of the human suffering they caused. Now there's a small percentage of patients, people with severe depression. So we're not talking people that the vast majority, 90% of the people that are prescribed these drugs by the millions. People with severe depression may indeed benefit from these drugs. But this literature showed is that the vast majority of people taking these drugs would be better off had they not started taking it. And so what do you do instead? There are things that work just as good as the drugs, not only placebos, but exercise, for example, can boost mood short-term, long-term, have some beneficial effects as well. And so look, even if that is placebo, even if exercising is a boost your mood through a placebo effect, well, hey, wouldn't you rather have the benefits, the side effects of exercise, rather than the side effects of Eli Lilly?
Amen. Well, as I sip on my cold brewed white tea.
Ooh, yummy.
Because I learned that when I brew my tea cold rather than with boiled water, I get a lot more bang for my leaf.
Your poor little leaves were getting scalded. What were you doing?
But it also gives me a calm, right? It makes me less depressed and gives me a calming feeling.
Oh, it's nice. Yeah. Tea's good stuff.
Yeah.
I got a whole beverage chapter just for you.
I loved it because I am, my partner Gary says I am a tea sommelier. I love my teas.
Ooh, well, we have to trade teas one of these days.
I've got a big drawer of bulk loose organic teas. But the thing is, when they tell you to brew tea, there's all these instructions about what temperature to brew them at, and nobody says brew them cold but Dr. Greger.
Well, no, Dr. Greger doesn't say it. He's just relaying the science. The science says it. I'm just passing it along.
Okay, well, it's good. I'm enjoying it. But I didn't have a lemon. I didn't have a lemon to put in my white tea, so I probably should have chose green tea, according to the information I read in How Not to Die.
Those are some of the kind of, tips and tricks that just kind of change my diet practically on a week-to-week basis when I learn some more stuff. But, the basic fundamentals are the same, right? Tea is healthy no matter how you drink it. It's kind of neat that through these kind of simple changes you can even, make it more powerful. So, look, you're going through the expense and the time it takes to brew some tea or eat a particular vegetable. You might as well kind of maximize its benefit for you.
I'm all for it. Now, can we talk, I don't even know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, sulforaphane.
Sulforaphane, yes.
Sulforaphane.
Bring it on.
chopping my vegetables and freezing, don't freeze. I was like, what's going on in this chapter?
No, you can freeze all you want. You just gotta add a little, you know, shred a little daikon radish or sprinkle some mustard powder on it, and all you need to do is add back the enzyme. Sulforaphane will be made from frozen broccoli, cooked broccoli, the precursors there. You're just wiping out the enzyme. No problem. Add some more enzyme.
Okay, so we don't want to chop our vegetables and cook them right away.
Well, you do not, right, because or cook them
green,
without chopping
green
at
vegetables.
All. Right, I mean, so if you're making broccoli soup and you just boil some broccoli, you chop and boil, then you've just wiped out the enzymes and the enzyme that makes sulforaphane from these heat-stable precursors. And so the sulforaphane is heat-stable, the precursors are heat-stable, but the enzyme that takes the precursors and makes sulforaphane is heat-sensitive and is destroyed rapidly and utterly by cooking. But all that precursor is still just sitting there, frozen broccoli, cooked broccoli. And so all you have to do is add some more enzyme. Where do you find enzyme? Well, what are mustard greens? Mustard greens are cruciferous vegetables, contain lots of this enzyme. Mustard greens come from mustard seeds. And what is mustard powder? That you can get at any store. Mustard powder is just powdered mustard seeds. And indeed, researchers found that sprinkling a little bit of mustard powder, which has packed with this enzyme that's still alive and kicking, can just make all the sulforaphane right there in your dish. You could also daikon radish, it's another, or any of the horseradish that's packed with sulforaphane. You could add a little of raw greens to your cooked greens. So if you could take some collard greens, boil them to death, and then just add a handful of raw arugula, right as you're going to eat it, almost as a garnish, or some slivers of purple cabbage or something, just to make it look pretty with a little delightful crunch. And you just add back the enzyme that'll revitalize all the sulforaphane production, and it's like you're eating the raw collard greens.
Mm, I mean, this is really good.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
now I have a
amazing
specific
stuff.
Question. Specific question for me only. I have a green juice every day. It's something I've been doing for the last 9 years since my cancer diagnosis. And so then a while ago I got a little lazy and I started to make a week's worth of juice and freezing them and just pulling them out once a day. So now my question is, can I do that? Or do I need to let the juice sit out for 45 minutes before I freeze it? Or do I add mustard powder to it? What do I do?
So the only reason freezing is bad is commercial freezing. So commercial freezing involves blanching. You take your vegetables, you pick them, and then you blanch them before you freeze them, because with the sole purpose of actually destroying the enzymes. You want to destroy the enzymes so they'll last longer in your frozen aisle at the store, which is fine as long as you do the mustard powder at the end. But it's not the freezing. It's the blanching, which is basically dipping in boiling water kind of thing. And so as long so you can freeze your green smoothie, your green drink, as long as you don't boil it first.
Okay. Whew.
And you can still even boil it first, but then you just got to do stuff later on.
That's good to know. The other thing is, I bought this mustard powder a long, long time ago from one of these Asian stores, and I rarely use it because it's so bitter. But now I know what to use it for.
There you go. You'll be out
in
no time.
I wanted to end up with something sweet. So can you explain to me, what is erythritol?
Yeah, so erythritol is a natural sugar alcohol, which is found in small quantities in grapes and melons and some other fruit. They just have, Cargill just makes it by the ton chemically. People hear of sugar alcohols like sorbitol, xylitol. The reason they're not used typically as kind of low-calorie sweeteners is because they're not absorbed into your system, so they end up in your colon, in your digestive tract, because they don't get absorbed, and then that actually draws water into the colon, causes watery diarrhea. And so that's why you only see xylitol, sorbitol, in things like candies, mints, chewing gum, in very small quantities, because you can take a little bit, it's not going to bother you. But you typically see a little on the label that says you eat too much, you know, you chew this whole pack of gum at a time, you may get diarrhea. Okay. Well, so it's safe, but it causes this unpleasant side effect. So that's why you'll never see xylitol soda, right? Because you got to have spoonfuls of something to make a whole soda sweet, right? Okay. So then along comes erythritol. So erythritol has the safety of sugar alcohols, but it's actually absorbed in the small intestine, then excreted unchanged in the urine. And so it doesn't make it down to the colon, so it doesn't have the diarrhea side effect, and so kind of presents this kind of optimum scenario of, well, wait a second, you get the sweetness at low calorie with some natural non-toxic product. But then I talk about, look, so yes, it's non-toxic, but even the most non-toxic sweetener still maintains one's hypersweet palate. You know, right? So let's say, yeah, fine, at home you're using erythritol to sweeten your tea or whatever with, but then you go outside, you can't find this stuff anywhere, and your palate is such, because you eat so much sweet stuff, that, you know, regular tea doesn't taste any good without it. And so you're walking around, you're eating sugar, you're eating desserts, you're eating more sweet things, because if you had not used any sweetener or reduced sweetener use, within a few weeks or months, your taste buds will change, and then ripe peach will be, you know, the most divine, wonderful, sweet thing you can imagine. But, you know, that peach after a bowl of Fruit Loops just doesn't taste sweet. It tastes sour. It tastes bitter. That's because we so screwed up our palate. In fact, no, we haven't. I mean, the industry very intentionally has screwed up our palate. So we're keyed up to that high salt, high fat, high sugar kind of. And so, so by using even the most non-toxic sweetener like erythritol, sprinkling that on your grapefruit, instead of just, eventually enjoying grapefruit raw, then without sweetener on top, you just have to keep that in the back of your mind and make sure you're not using it. You're not finding yourself maintaining your sweet tooth in a way that's detrimental to your health. But look, you know, grapefruits are super healthy. If you're not going to eat it without sprinkling sugar on top, it would be better to sprinkle erythritol than sugar.
Okay. Well, Dr. Greger, we've come to the end of the program. I can't believe it. I have so many more things to talk about. But basically, people, you're just going to have to read the book. It's just too loaded with great stuff. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for being you. Michael, I love you, and all the best with this book.
So happy to be on the program. I hope to see you soon.
Me too. Okay. Woo! All right, that was Dr. Greger, and I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for listening, and remember, have a delicious week.